to assemble the devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. So, how many are here for the first time? First time guests, please could raise your hand. Just a few. How many? Yeah, Josh. How many here for like about the thousandth time? Okay. All right. So I've mentioned before that the challenge of the for the Sunday feast lecture is to try to say something that's going to be understandable and relevant to the people who are here for the first time, and at the same time, interesting for the people who are here for the 1,000th time. So wish me luck. I'm going to try. Hope with your blessings, hopefully I'll be able to do that. I'm going to start off by reading a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, it's titled Transcendental Knowledge, and this will be text 35. And I'll read the chant the Sanskrit, read the word-for-word translation, the translation in Srila Prabhupada's purport, which is a commentary on that verse, and then, you know, sort of speak about that verse in general. And I guess I'll, since I'm the only one who has a book, basically, and the verse is not written up, I'll just chant it myself. We won't do responsive chanting. So it goes, Yajgyatvana punarmoham evam yasyasi pandava yena bhutani yasheshani draksyasyatmani atomai. Translation. Actually, I won't read the word for word. I'll just read the translation and Prabhupada's commentary. So the translation is, having obtained, this is Lord Sri Krishna speaking, okay? He's speaking to Arjuna, who he's having a conversation with. So having obtained real knowledge from a self-realized soul, you will never fall again into such illusion, for by this knowledge you will see that all living beings are but part of the Supreme, or, in other words, that they are mine. So just for the benefit of the people here for the first time, there are about a half a dozen of you. Bhagavad Gita is a conversation between Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supreme Being, who's a person. And when he was here on Earth 5,000 years ago, and at that time he spoke, he imparted knowledge to his friend and disciple, Arjuna. Arjuna was, he was a military general. He happened to be a friend of Krishna. And the setting for the Bhagavad Gita was it actually took place on a battlefield. This conversation took place on a battlefield just before the onset of what was the equivalent of a civil war at that time. It was like a fratricidal war. It was a war for the kingdom, basically. And Arjuna, he was the military general, and when he got there to the battlefield and he saw that all his friends and relatives and teachers, all his significant others, so to speak, were there on the opposing army, ready to fight and, to the death, he became a little bit bewildered. And he started feeling like, why am I doing this? What am I doing? You know, like, we're fighting for the kingdom. What's the use of having a kingdom if we have to get it at the expense of having to kill all our friends and relatives and teachers and everybody like that? So he was thinking, you know, he's having second thoughts about the whole thing. And he started presenting that to Krishna. He started presenting all these arguments to Krishna why maybe it's not such a good idea that we go through with this. Maybe it's better just let him have the kingdom and, you know, I'll just be content to just live some other way. And anyway, so that, you know, went back and forth. He was presenting his different reasons to Krishna why he thought maybe it wasn't such a good idea to fight. But ultimately Krishna counted those arguments, and ultimately Krishna, and at one point Arjuna realized, you know, he was just, even though he's presenting all these arguments, Krishna was presenting counter-arguments, he was still confused. He's becoming more confused than ever. So at one point Arjuna actually said, he said, Karpanya dosopata swabhava prichami tvam dharma samudha cheta yachtaya siyam nichitam bruhitane sishyas teham sarimam pram tvapanam. He said to Krishna, now I am confused about my duty and have lost all composure due to weakness. In this condition, I am asking you to tell me clearly what is best for me. Now I'm your disciple, a soul surrendered unto you. Please instruct me. So at some point, he accepted Krishna as his spiritual master, you know, and he was, in so many words, he was saying that, okay, Krishna, I accept that we're not on an equal level, you know, and you're in a superior position of knowledge. Please just tell me what is the proper way to understand this and what should I do? And then Krishna did. He responded to that, and what Krishna had to say after, you know, responding to that question of Arjuna, so it's that statement of Arjuna, that's the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita was spoken not just for Arjuna's benefit, but it was spoken for the benefit of the humanity, for time immemorial. You know, it's like, I mean, Krishna was speaking to Arjuna, but, you know, he was conscious of the fact that he was imparting instruction that would be beneficial for the entire human race, for, you know, the rest of this creation. So we're in the fourth chapter here, and, you know, so Krishna's already kind of well into his instruction to Arjuna. And I'll just read this. This is the statement Krishna made again. Having obtained real knowledge from a self-realized soul, you will never fall again into such illusion. For by this knowledge you will see that all living beings are but part of the Supreme, or in other words, that they are mine. And this is Srila Prabhupada's commentary on this. He says, the result of receiving knowledge from a self-realized soul, or one who knows things as they are, is learning that all living beings are parts and parcels of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna. The sense of an existence separate from Krishna is called maya. Ma means not, and ya means this. Some think that we have nothing to do with Krishna, that Krishna is only a great historical personality, and that the Absolute is impersonal Brahman. Factually, as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, this impersonal Brahman is the personal effulgence of Krishna. In other words, it's subordinate to Krishna. There is such a thing as the impersonal Brahman, but it's subordinate to Krishna. Krishna, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the cause of everything. In the Brahma Samhita, it is clearly stated that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes. Even the millions of incarnations are only his different expansions. Similarly, the living entities are also expansions of Krishna. The Mayavadi philosophers wrongly think that Krishna loses his own separate existence in his many expansions. This thought is material in nature. We have experience in the material world that a thing, when fragmentally distributed, loses its own original identity. But the Mayavadi philosophers fail to understand that absolute means that 1 plus 1 is equal to 1, and that 1 minus 1 is equal to 1. This is the case in the absolute world. So just before we go on to the next paragraph, for extra credit points, can anybody quote the verse here that Prabhupada's referring to where it's stated that Krishna is, even the millions of incarnations are only his different expansions? Can anybody quote that verse? We have I see a few of the brahmacharis are here. Okay, actually that's a good, I didn't think of that one, but that's right. That does say that. I was thinking of ete chamsa kala Krishna apumsa Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam. There's a verse in the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam that says there's so many different incarnations, but Krishna is the Swayam Bhagavan. He's the original Supreme Personality of God, and all the incarnations are actually expansions of him. But Prabhu here also quoted another verse in the Brahmi Samhita, which basically says the same thing. Okay, can anybody quote a verse that says the living entities are also expansions of Krishna? Well, if you could quote this verse, you would have got it, because this verse is saying that. Any other verse? Anybody? Any Bhagavad Gita scholars here? Okay, there's one in the 15th chapter. Krishna says, Mamai Vamso Jiva Loke, Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, Manaksastrani Indriyani, Prakriti Stani Karshati. That these living entities are my eternal fragmental parts and parcels, and they're struggling hard with the six senses, and which includes the mind. So there's different places where Krishna states these two really important points, that he's the original cause of everything, and even all the other incarnations or avatars or expansions of himself. He's referred to as avatari, which means the source of all the incarnations, or Swayam Bhagavan, the original personality of Godhead. And all the jivas, which is in essence what we are jivas in material bodies. So we're all spiritual expansions of Krishna as well. We're part of Krishna's spiritual family. We're Krishna's, you could say, spiritual offspring. Just like here in the material world, you know, like a man and a woman, they have children. Sometimes they're referred to as offspring. Oh, those are your offspring? Yeah, children. So we are Krishna's spiritual offspring. We're Krishna's spiritual children. Anyway, reading on here. It says, for want of sufficient knowledge in the absolute science, we are now covered with illusion. And therefore we think that we are separate from Krishna. Although we are separated parts of Krishna, we are nevertheless not different from him. The bodily difference of the living entities is maya, or not actual fact. We are all meant to satisfy Krishna. By maya alone, Arjuna thought that the temporary bodily relationship with his kinsman was more important than his eternal spiritual relationship with Krishna. The whole teaching of the Gita is targeted towards this end, that a living entity, as Krishna's eternal servitor, cannot be separated from Krishna, and his sense of being an identity apart from Krishna is called Maya. The living entities, as separate parts and parcels of the Supreme, have a purpose to fulfill. Having forgotten that purpose since time immemorial, they are situated in different bodies, as men, animals, demigods, etc. Such bodily differences arise from forgetfulness of the transcendental service of the Lord. But when one is engaged in the transcendental service through Krishna consciousness, one becomes at once liberated from this illusion. One can acquire such pure knowledge only from the bona fide spiritual master, and thereby avoid the delusion that the living entity is equal to Krishna. Perfect knowledge is that the supreme soul, Krishna, is the supreme shelter for all living entities. And giving up such shelter, the living entities are deluded by the material energy, imagining themselves to have a separate identity. Thus, under different standards of material identity, they become forgetful of Krishna. When, however, such deluded living entities become situated in Krishna consciousness, it is to be understood that they are on the path of liberation, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, text chapter 10, text 6, Muktir Hitvanyata Rupam Swarupena Vivastiti. Liberation means to be situated in one's constitutional position as an eternal servant of Krishna, Krishna consciousness. Om Aginata Mananda Shajan Anjana Shalakaya Chakshurna Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurudeva Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam. So, as I mentioned, so for those of you who are here for the, you know, like the thousandth time or the hundredth time, at least you got to hear the philosophy of Krishna consciousness presented in its perfection. You know, one of Srila Prabhupada's purports. And hopefully you can, it's still ringing in your ears. And, you know, while you're hearing a lot of the things I'm saying that may be directed for people who are more newcomers, you can be still relishing that, what you just heard. And I'm also going to be trying to refer to a lot of these points here in the purport. So we'd like to welcome everybody to our Sunday feast program. An ongoing struggle with this microphone, but let's see, I'll give it one last try. Yeah, that looks like it's going to stay. Okay, good. Yeah, that works. That's great. Thank you. We'd like to welcome everybody to our Sunday feast program. Where this temple is called New Dwarka, and we're a branch of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, also known as the Hare Krishna Movement. And we're also with the L.A. branch of the Brahma, Madhva, Gaudiya, Vaishnav Sampradaya. So everybody understands perfectly what that is, so there's no need for me to explain anything, right? No. Okay. I'll explain a little bit. But technically, that's what we are. We're a branch. We're the Los Angeles branch of the Brahma, Madhva, Gaudiya, Vaishnav, Sampradaya. So Vaishnav, Sanskrit word. Does anybody know what it means, Vaishnav? Okay, here it is. Yeah, basically, devotee of Krishna. That's actually how Prabhupada... In the glossary of the Bhagavad Gita, well, actually Prabhupada says devotee of the Supreme Lord. But as we know, Supreme Lord is Krishna. So Vaishnava, and it derives, technically, I mean, if you could break it down from the sense, Vaishnava means worship of Vishnu, worshiper of Vishnu, okay? But as we just heard from that in this purport here, Vishnu is actually an expansion of Krishna. Vishnu is not the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna actually is. So it's probably... It's equally as correct, if not more correct, and say that a Vaishnav is somebody who's a follower of the teachings and a worshiper of Krishna, the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. Okay, so we are Vaishnavs. We're worshipers, followers of the teachings of Krishna and worshipers of Krishna. Sampradaya, does anybody know what that word means? Sampradaya? Oh, let's get somebody different. Yeah, Sampradaya. Sampradaya means like a line, you know. Sampradaya means like a succession. Actually, Sampradaya is a Sanskrit word for disciplic succession, basically. So it's referring to a line. And Gaudiya. Gaudiya refers to Bengal or Orissa. And Madhva is one of the Sampradaya Acharya. Well, actually, it's referring to a geographical location, which is Bengal and Orissa. But it's significant because 500 years ago, Krishna was here. I was here present on earth as Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya is Krishna. He's not a... this is an interesting point, actually. Lord Chaitanya is not an avatar of Krishna. Lord Chaitanya is simultaneously the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, like, for instance, Ram, Vishnu, Korma, Varaha, et cetera, et cetera. You know, let's see, if I remember that song, the Das Avatar is Matsya Korma Varaha Nishringa Vamana. Like, okay. Yeah, so they're all expansions of Krishna, whereas Lord Chaitanya is actually Krishna. Okay, so Krishna was here as Lord Chaitanya 500 years ago, and he took birth in Gaudiya, right? Because my son-in-law is up there, he's from that place. And so that's why that's mentioned. The Gaudiya is referring to, you know, Lord Chaitanya, basically. Madhvacharya, he's one of the, what's called the Sampradayacharya. He's one of the great teachers in this line. And he lived approximately 1,500 years ago, or I'm a little rusty on my dates here, but between 1,000 and 1,500 years ago. That's a few hundred years, give or take. You know. But he's a great acharya. And then the Sampradaya, what's called the Sampradaya Acharya is Lord Brahma. Brahma being the demigod who's in charge of the chief engineer of this entire universe. So he's the originator of this Sampradaya. There are four Sampradayas. One starts with Lord Brahma. One with, actually, who knows? Who knows the four Vaishnav Sampradayas? These are really kind of basic points in our, you know, philosophy. Does anybody know the four Vaishnav Sampradayas? Anybody who doesn't know that thinks they know, before I call on the people who really I know they know? Okay, go ahead. Oh, yeah, go ahead. What do you think? Ruja is, right. Shri is, yep. Right, yeah. Kumar Sampradaya. So those are the four. There's one that starts with Lord Brahma. No, Rupanuga Sampradaya. No, Rupanuga, the word Rupanuga means a follower of Rupa Goswami. It's not a Sampradaya. It's a, I don't know how you refer to it, but we are Rupanugas. No, Rupa Goswami was one of the chief disciples of Lord Chaitanya. And we are Rupanugas. We are followers of the teachings of Rupa Goswami. Actually, right before I started speaking, I chanted those two prayers. And the second one goes, Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam. And I'll read you the translation for that. It says, when will Srila Rupa Goswami Prabhupada, who is established within this material world, the mission to fulfill the desire of Lord Chaitanya, so he's giving credit for having established the mission to fulfill the desire of Lord Chaitanya in this material world. And the prayer is, when will he give me shelter under his lotus feet? So we are Rupanugas, but there's not a Rupanuga Sampradaya. But it is important. Sorry? Oh, yeah? Well, they made a mistake. Sorry to tell you. But it's okay. It's auspicious just to hear. Okay, you could check again. And we could talk more. But it's not a Sampradaya. So we are members of this Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Vaishnav Sampradaya. And as we already mentioned, we, unlike the other three Sampradayas, our understanding is that Krishna, not Vishnu, is the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan. And as a matter of fact, he's right here. There he is right there on the altar. That's Krishna. And standing next to Krishna is, well, Rukmini. Our deities are called Rukmini Dwarkadish. But actually, these are Radha Krishna deities. And Rukmini is actually an expansion of Radharani. Radharani is Krishna's divine female counterpart. She's the original spiritual potency, and she's the embodiment of divine love. And that's her there. And somebody might question, well, how is it possible you're saying that, you know, God and his eternal consort are standing right there on this altar, all those, you know, two statues? And, yeah, we are. We're saying that. And, you know, one way to understand this is, well, Prabhupada would give the example. Well, the basic understanding is this, that, you know, the Supreme Person, you know, Krishna, the Supreme Person, is all-pervading throughout time and space. He's aware of everything. That's a lot to be aware of. He's aware of everything, past, present, and future. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Vedaham samatichani vartamanani charjuna bhavishyani chabutani mam tu vedana kaschana. I know everything that's happening. I know everything that's happened in the past, all things that are happening at present, and all things that are yet to come. I know all living entities, but me no one knows. So Krishna's understanding everything, past, present, and future, everywhere. He's all-pervading, once again, through time and space. He's in control of everything. He's in control of everything, both in the spiritual and the material worlds. Maya jakshena prakate suyate sacharachanam. You know, everything's working under Krishna's direction, even here in the material world. Krishna is present within every atom, you know, within the heart of every living entity. And ultimately, he is in control of everything. And he is Suridam Sarvabhutanam. He's the best friend of every living entity. You know, Krishna is the ultimate well-wisher for every living creature, every, as we mentioned, spiritual offspring that is in a material body at the moment. Krishna is our well-wisher. Krishna is wanting us to become, to get out of this material world and to, you know, go back and be with him again in the spiritual world. See? So, to get to the point, Krishna, as a means to that end, comes as the deity, you know. Who can say no? He accepts the form, what's called the Archa Vigraha. Archa Vigraha means it's a type of incarnation. And he accepts this form to make it convenient for his devotees to worship him, to relate to him. See? Because here Krishna is, so we can come and see Krishna. We can sing and dance for Krishna's pleasure. You know, when you've come a little bit further progressed in this way of life, you can help Krishna. You can assist Krishna in dressing himself. You can cook for Krishna. There's so many different ways in which you can actually interact with Krishna because he's made himself available or accessible in the deity form. And just like you give a, you know, like an example, just say, for instance, if President Obama wanted to come here, you know, who could say no? You could say, you can't say no, you have to stay in the White House. No. He wants. He's a president. He can come here, and nobody could stop him. And if he, you know, just if he wanted to do that to make it easy for us to say get to know him or interact with him, so in the same way, an ordinary powerful person could do that. What to speak of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Prabhupada gives the example someplace in the Bhagavad Gita that just like there might be some of you know, just to help us understand how the deity is actually an empowered form of Krishna. He gives the example of a mailbox, and there might be so many boxes on the street, but if you take a letter and you put it in just any old box, it'll just sit there, or maybe at best it'll get dragged away to the garbage. But if you put your letter in the mailbox, you know, the authorized box by the United States Post Office, then that letter will be picked up and it'll be taken to its destination. Wherever that is, you know, New York, Miami, whatever, you know, Honolulu, if you have the sufficient postage on it, then it'll go to where it's supposed to go. So in the same way, when we worship Krishna as the Archa-Vigraha, because this is an authorized process, you know, the deity is empowered, or it is Krishna, and that worship is accepted. Krishna is there. He's personally present as the deity to accept our service and reciprocate with us. It's not one way. He doesn't just accept the service, but he actually reciprocates with the devotee. And that reciprocation takes the form of, basically Krishna enlightening us, you know, as to our spiritual position. In the ninth, I think it's the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it's a nice verse. Krishna says, Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mama priyantite. So those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. And he goes, Tesham eva anakam partam aham agyana jam tamaha nasyami atma bhavishto gyana dipena bhashra. To show them special mercy, I who am dwelling within their heart, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. So that's the result of serving Krishna. you know, worshiping Krishna, trying to render service to Krishna, that he is pleased. He accepts that service. And if we're doing it nicely with devotion, as it's stated in that verse, Bhajatam Priti Porvakam, regularly, Satatam, Kirtay, how's it going? Tesham Satatayuktanam, regularly, with Bhajatam Priti Porvakam, with love and devotion, then the result will be that Krishna, Nasyami Atmabhavashto, Dhyana Dipena Bhashta. Krishna will destroy with, it's a metaphor, but it's a very nice one. Krishna will destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. In other words, he'll enlighten us. He'll enable us to once again understand that we're actually nothing to do with these material bodies, that we're actually his, as we mentioned, his spiritual offspring, you know, we're his eternal servants. That's our, that's who we really are. And he'll allow, enable us to understand that. He'll lift up that veil of Maya so that we once again be reinstated in our original constitutional position. That verse was quoted here, Prabhupada quoted in that prophet, Muktir Hitvanyata Rupam Svarupena Vyavastiti, which means that liberation means to be situated in one's constitutional position as the eternal servant of Krishna. Notice Krishna will give us that realization that that's who we really are, and we'll be able to be very, you know, firmly established in devotional service with that understanding. So, yeah, so we also mentioned already how, you know, our, where we come into the picture, where the spiritual expansions of Krishna, the, you know, the spiritual offsprings. Actually, I quoted that verse, Mamai Vamso Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, that the second part of that, the second two lines is Manakstastrani Indriyani Pakatistani Karshati, but so it says how the living entities, Krishna says, the living entities are my eternal, fragmental. That's a significant little phrase there too, that we're eternal, we're fragmental, but we're eternally fragmental. And I'll get to that in a second, how that's important. We're eternally fragmental, parts and parcels. And then Krishna goes on to say, but manakstastani indriyani prakritistani karshati, but we're struggling hard with the six senses, which include the mind. In other words, we're actually, you know, we're not in the best of all possible situations here in the material world. And we're not, this is not ideally where we're supposed to be. Ideally, we're supposed to be in the spiritual world with Krishna, in our Swarup City. And, you know, Swarup City means one's own perfection of one's Swarup. It means you're situated in your eternal spiritual form and rendering service to Krishna. But due to misuse of our free will, we're here in the material world, packed up in this material body. But the good news is that we're packed up in human material bodies, and this human form of life is the form of life we can utilize to get out, to become free from the cycle of birth and death, and go back to be with Krishna in the spiritual world. And one point that I that verse kind of like touches upon, I wanted to mention, is that unlike the you know, there's different schools of philosophy within the Vedic tradition. And, you know, we're not the only, the competing school of philosophy within the Vedic tradition is called Advaita Vedanta. And, Advaita Vedantists also, believe or have the same understanding that we are not these material bodies, we're essentially something more than that. And that if we, one goal of life is to become free from the cycle of birth and death. But the Advaita Vedantists, also sometimes referred to as monist, that's a Western philosophical terminology, monist or Advaita Vedantist, they believe that liberation means merging into the formless light, you know, the Krishna's, merging into Krishna's spiritual effulgence. That's what they think is the highest level of spiritual realization or spiritual achievement. And Prabhupada referred to that here in his purport a couple times, you know, when he talked about the Mayavadi philosophers. But so I just wanted to make the point that Krishna himself says in the Bhagavad Gita, Brahmano hi pratishtham, he's the basis of this impersonal Brahman. It's not the highest. It's not like a total imagination, but it's something that does exist. But it's not the highest level of spiritual realization to merge into the, you know, this, how would you say it, homogeneous spiritual continuum, Krishna's spiritual effulgence, right? Actually, devotees don't desire that at all. You know, they desire to, as we already mentioned, have been, you know, involved in a personal, loving relationship with Krishna. So that's, you know, where we kind of like break paths, so to speak, with the Advaita Vedantists. You know, the philosophy is similar up to a point, and that, you know, we're both believing in that we're not this material body, and that, you know, one of the goals of human life is to become free from the cycle of birth and death. But then when it comes to the conception of moksha or liberation, you know, what is the ultimate goal, then we, you know, like sort of go diametrically opposite. Sometimes the analogy is given, their analogy is like a liberation or you know, we'll use the word moksha, that's the word they use, is like a drop of water going into the ocean. When the drop goes into the ocean, that's it, it just merges, and there's no longer an individual drop. But we use the analogy that we don't use the word moksha so much. But our conception of enlightenment is more like a person waking up from a dream. You know, when you're asleep, that's you. And you're experiencing things when you're asleep. You're dreaming, you're experiencing this, that, whatever, you know, all sorts of different things. Sometimes pleasant, sometimes unpleasant, sometimes they kind of make sense, sometimes they make no sense at all. But most people would agree that when you wake up, you know, that's also you, of course, but you're in touch with more important aspects of reality when you're awake than when you're asleep. So that's the kind of the analogy that we give, that, you know, we're like, when we're in material condition life, it's like a person who's asleep. We're in a dreaming condition right now. We're dreaming. And as Prabhupada actually mentioned, he kind of touched upon that in the purport. You know, let's see if I can find it real quick. Well, I can't find the exact words, but if you were listening carefully, you know, you heard that. It's just it's a delusion, thinking that, you know, we have an existence separate from Krishna. It's like a dream that we are these material bodies. And when we wake up from this dream that we are these material bodies, then we'll understand. We'll be, you know, the same person. We'll continue to be a person, but we'll understand that who we really are, what our real identity is, and what our relationship is with Krishna. There's a nice verse in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna tells Arjuna, he says, Natu eva ham jatu nasam, natvam ne me janati pa. Sarve vayama takparam. You know, sort of substantiating this point, he tells Arjuna, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, referring to all the other soldiers that were on the battlefield there, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. See? So in other words, Krishna is clearly stating that, you know, individuality is not a temporary thing, it's not an illusory thing. Actually, individuality is the ultimate basis of reality. Krishna's an individual, and we're individuals as well, and that's the basis of reality. It's not something that's you have to become free of, or when you become more elevated, you know. So that's, you know, one very significant difference between our way, you know, our understanding of the Vedic philosophy and that other school of philosophy, Advaita Vedanta. Let's see. Okay, I guess one last point, and I could maybe take some questions if there are any, is that somebody might question, well, how can you justify any of this? In other words, is this just all claims? You know, sometimes people, they don't like the idea that of you know, religions or you know, receiving knowledge from a scripture, because they feel like, well, you know, it's like it's stated, and then you're just supposed to accept it, and it's not, you know, can you substantiate this in any way? Can you justify this point that, you know, we're something more than or other than just this material body? And yeah, actually we can. I mean, for us, it is significant that Krishna himself says it in the Bhagavad Gita. And, you know, there's like a certain, there's logic you can, Prabhupada used to like, was fond of presenting this example that, well, we have a body now and we can see that body's changing. You know, you don't have the same body now as you had 20 years ago or 40 years ago, if any of you are that old, you know. or 60 years ago. The body's changing, but the inner person is the same. So why not another change from one body, you know, to another body like that? So, you know, Prabhupada would present like a logical argument, making use of that analogy. But beyond that, there is there's evidence that supports the idea that the survival of human personality after death, comes as different categories. There's children who remember their past lives. There's people who've had out-of-body experiences. There's, these have been studied by mainstream scientists and communications from the dead, apparitions of the dead, cases of possession. So these are all, types of evidence that support this idea that, we are something more than just this material body. And another thing that's very interesting is that, what does the competition have to say? Well, if you never had any contact with this and you're just like an ordinary person, a kid going to school, and you're going to taking a biology course, what you would read in your biology textbook is that consciousness, which is the most familiar aspect of our existence, although at the same time it's the greatest mystery to ordinary people. Consciousness emerges at a mature stage of biological development. Okay, that's the position. That's what you'd read in the biology textbooks. Consciousness just emerges at a mature stage of biological development. It's pretty clear, right? And that's when the fetus, the embryo, develops to a certain stage of sophistication. Consciousness is there, and as it develops more, the consciousness becomes more developed. That's their idea, and the opposite of that holds true too. That when the biological development breaks down, time of death, that's the end of consciousness. So there's nothing that continues on. No question of life after death, because there is nothing that survives death. There's no there's nothing. There's no spiritual element there that survives the demise of the material body. So that's their idea. At least that's what's stated. That's what's stated in even the biology textbooks. Of course, that's contradicted by those different groups of evidence that I just mentioned. And on top of that, I found something interesting when I was preparing for this class. I was reading on the internet about consciousness, I read an article on the Wikipedia just to see what, the understanding is of somebody who's not a devotee of Krishna, just, somebody who's from that way of thinking. So I found two interesting statements. One was, this is a couple sentences from a book written by Richard Dawkins. Maybe some of you have heard that name. He's kind of like a famous atheist. And he wrote a book in 1976 called The Selfish Gene. So I thought this was an interesting admission on his part. He said, the evolution of the capacity to simulate seems to have culminated in subjective consciousness. Why this should have happened is, to me, the most profound mystery facing modern biology. See, so in other words, if you
stop and think about that, what's it saying?
Because, they're making the claim that consciousness comes about at a mature stage of biological development, but he's making the point that, why that should have happened like that, it's the most profound mystery. What to speak of how it happened? One of the accusations that's kind of leveled at not just us, but religions in general, is you people, something stated in your scripture, and everybody's just supposed to believe it. There's a difference between claims and facts. You guys are just taking shelter of claims. But here, it's stated in these biology textbooks all throughout the world, for I don't know how many years now, that what I said, consciousness is coming about at a mature stage of biological development. That's just a claim. And they're admitting it. And they're admitting what a hollow claim it is. He's admitting here, why this should happen. They don't understand why it happened, and they don't understand how it happened. They can't specify that this is what happened first, and then this happened, step by step. If you really understand the process, how something came about, then you should be able to explain. This is what happened first. This is what happened second. This is what happened third. This is what happened fourth. And this is, and like that. They can't do that. They can't, describe the process by which it happened. Now, here's something even more interesting. That was 1976. In 2004, eight neuroscientists wrote a book called The Human Brain Function. And this is just one sentence, but, it's a very interesting sentence in this book. One of the authors of the book said, "We have no idea how consciousness emerges from the physical activity of the brain." So, you know, basically they're admitting, you know, they're just making a claim. They're saying that's how it happened. But at the same time, here are these, this is just back 2004, that's only 8 years ago. These are, you know, eight top neuroscientists, and they're clearly just saying, we have no idea how consciousness emerges from physical activity of the brain. So they're saying that it happens, but they're, simultaneously they're saying that they don't have any idea how it happens. So why do we have to accept that? Why do we have to accept that when, at least, you know, there is empiric evidence to the contrary? There's, you know, logical arguments that seem to, you know, that you could present. And Krishna, you know, I mean, who's right about so many other things, is also making, you know, clear statements that, you know, that don't support that to the opposite. So, in other words, what I'm getting at is this, that even these, you know, these, the scientists who did the research on this phenomenon of kids remembering past lives and things like that, they came up with the statement that one can rationally believe in survival of human personality after death. So, you know, in that mood, what I'm saying is I think it's based upon statements from the scriptures, logic, and empiric evidence, I think one can rationally come to the conclusion that this worldview, you know, the Vaishnav Vedic worldview, is worthy of serious further consideration. See, I'm not going as far as to say, although that's what I believe, but just to be a bit guarded in my statement, I'm just saying, I'm not going as far as to say this is the absolute truth, because that's, I mean, as I said, that's what I believe. But just, you know, if I say I was talking to somebody who wasn't already a Hare Krishna devotee, I really feel confident that I'm presenting a very compelling argument, and that a person who's reasonable, thoughtful, not biased, should at least be willing to give this worldview further serious consideration. Just based upon that, you know, here's consciousness, as I mentioned, it's the most familiar part of our existence. But science doesn't understand it at all, and they're admitting it, right? Other religions, like, you know, other mainstream religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, okay, they have a different understanding we have, and their understanding is not supported by at least the empiric evidence. Like, for instance, we believe in reincarnation. As far as, you know, those other religions go, it contradicts, you know, what's in their scriptures. So it's not supported by that. So, you know, I guess what I'm basically leading into is that, you know, say people, not everybody, but there's a lot of people that they want spiritual life. You know, they want to, you know, believe that there's a God and that there is spiritual life. And okay, but, you know, they're like, but at the same time, nobody wants to just kind of like dive into something and, you know, purchase the wrong product, so to speak. So what I'm suggesting is that, you know, just based on these things, I think it's reasonable for any person to study further into, you know, this Krishna consciousness and try practicing it. It's rational, you know, just based on what we even just said here this evening. It's not, and you could, you know, you could try to present this to people you meet. It might take some practice to kind of get your arguments together, but I think it's like, definitely something that's a reasonable request you can make of anybody. I made it of my son earlier this evening. He came to visit me for the first time in a long time. I wasn't successful, but anyway, I gave him a good, he's a dyed-in-the-wool skeptic studying psychology at Alliance University in Alhambra. But anyway, I'm not done with him. I haven't. It hasn't finished. But in any event, I feel convinced about this, that, you know, we're not kidding ourselves. We're not just like, oh, you know, you're weak people. You just need something. You need the crutch to, no. This is rational. We've got good reasons to be doing what we're doing. And you know, those who do it seriously have get more than just like arguments and reasons to feel that you're on the right track. You get experience. If you practice Krishna consciousness seriously and sincerely, it doesn't take long. Krishna reciprocates. You know, Krishna awards a sincere, serious practitioner what we refer to as a higher taste. There's a verse in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Vishayavanivartante Nihaharashadehina Rasavarjamasopiyasya Padam Drishtvanavartate, that Krishna says the embodied soul may be restricted from sense gratification, but the taste, the desire for it still remains. But then he goes on to say, but ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, Padam Drishtva, and it becomes fixed. So the idea is that if you practice Krishna consciousness seriously, sincerely, then you experience that Padam Drishtva, that higher taste. When you're chanting, for instance, you experience how this Hare Krishna mantra is Golek. It's not something of this. It's not a mundane sound vibration. Prabhu here is experiencing that. Otherwise, there's no way he could be chanting so often, for so many years. Right? You experience Golokera Premadana Harinama Sankirtana. This stated in the scriptures that this Hare Krishna mantra is descending from the spiritual world. It's actually a spiritual sound vibration. Nama Chintamani Krishna's Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha Puna Shuddha Nitya Mukta Binat Bam Nama Namino. It's completely spiritual. It's completely transcendental. It's completely not different from Krishna. So as you practice Krishna consciousness, Krishna allows you to a degree, you know, Yaya Tamam Papajante, Tamsa Taiva Bajamiam. As they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. The more we surrender, the more Krishna will allow us to experience that, yeah, this is really all true. And you'll experience that in the form of that higher taste. And and simultaneously, you know, increasing conviction about all the different things in the philosophy. Anyway, I'll stop there. It's probably about time anyway. Does anybody have any questions or comments about any of these points? Complaints. Our friend here had a complaint that there's a Rupanuga Sampradaya, but corrections or whatever. Okay. Yeah. You gotta speak loud because I might be a little hard of hearing. I don't know if there's a microphone that's here available. So maybe just shout it out. Okay, so let me see if I heard you, because if God's creation is perfect, why is it necessary for you to go out and distribute this knowledge? People are either serving Krishna, Mahamaya or Yogamaya, and they're happily doing their thing. Okay, did I understand your question? Did I get it? Is that the question? Okay. Well, the people who are Mahamaya, they might think they're happy, but, you know, we know better. We know better. We know it's like somebody might be on a riverboat. You know, just kind of picture this little example. You're on like one of these old-fashioned riverboats, you know, that you see in the movies when you're a kid with the paddle wheel, and you're going down, and everybody on the riverboat's having a grand old time. There's music playing, and they're serving out nice food, and everybody's dancing and singing. But meantime, they don't know, but that it's coming to a waterfall, and then and that's the end of everybody. So that's what that they're heading in that direction. The people who are serving Mahamaya, who are just, fully absorbed in the materialistic activities, they're just deepening their entanglement in this cycle of birth and death. And so at the end of their life, they're going to just have to take birth again in the material world. And depending upon the quality of their activities, that will determine their next birth. They might not even get a human body. Actually, if people have no contact at all with spiritual life, if they've made no attempt whatsoever to improve themselves spiritually while, in this human form of life, then there's a very good possibility that they're not going to get the human body again. And that's a real, that's not good, because it takes a long time to evolve back up from the lower species back up to the human form again. So we want to save them from that. We want to the reason why we have to go out and try to give this knowledge to other people is because we don't want to see them suffer. know, even they might not think that they're suffering, but we can understand what's in store for them at the end of their life if they are just, you know, leading a totally, completely materialistic life and disregarding, you know, the spiritual dimension of life altogether. So we don't want to see that happen to them. So it's compassion, basically, you know. And it's one of the reasons. It's part of our motivation. Another part of our motivation is that it's a great way to make spiritual advancement for ourselves, you know. But another, as I said, another part of that motivation is we don't want to see them suffer when they don't have to. So we go out and try to share it with other people. And actually, that's the service. Right towards the end of the Bhagavad Gita says, there's no servant in the world more dear to me than one who tries to explain this message to the, he says the devotees, but it means the innocent people. See, there's people, there's different categories of people out there. There's people that are atheistic, and it's recommended that, you know, for the preacher, it's recommended to, well, there's four categories. There's the second-class devotee, the Majjhimadikarya. He worships the Supreme Lord. He makes friends with people who are already devotees. He preaches to the innocent, and that's who Krishna's referring to towards the Bhagavad Gita, at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, and he avoids the people who are dyed-in-the-wool atheists. You know, the people who have already totally made up their mind, they're atheists, they don't want to, we avoid them. But there's a lot of people out there that are innocent. There's a lot of people out there, as I said, that they want spiritual life. You know, they really do want it, but they're just kind of like bewildered. And, you know, they're not getting a lot of guidance from, where do they get the guidance? They're not getting guidance from their parents. They're not getting guidance from the teachers. They don't get guidance from the government. These, you know, they're incapable of giving any guidance. So they're just out there. They're confused and bewildered. And they really, but they, you know, they want it. They want something. They want to understand about God. And you could, you know, we know people. There are plenty of people in that category because we go out and we meet them all the time. So those are the people that we have to get out there, and we have to try to give them this information, because when they come in contact with it, they take advantage of it, like yourself. You're a relatively new devotee. How did you get involved? Did you just come to the temple just? I mean, did you meet a devotee before you came? Yeah, you met a devotee. Somebody bothered to try to reach out to you. Somebody who is a devotee here at the temple, rather than just sit around and eat a lot of prasadam one day, decided to, let me put some books in a bag and go out someplace, and they met you. And they gave you a book, and you appreciated what was in the book, and here you are today. Are you glad you're here? There we go. So that's why we need to go out and preach. Uh-huh. Well, the person saying they don't care about their next life, that's implying that they believe there is a next life. So, you know, why, if they're saying, oh, you don't care about your next life, so by saying it like that, they're indicating that they believe there is a next life. So that you have to just ask them, you don't think that what you do in this life has anything to do with what happens to you in your next life? You think it's just, what's your understanding then? What will determine your next life? If it's not the things you do, the quality of your activities during this life, that's not going to have any bearing or any influence on what you are in your next life? Because by your own statement, your own words, you're saying you don't care about your next life. So that's one logical thing you could present to them. And then if they go, well, actually, I don't even believe in the next life. And then you could present to them, well, you know, aside from just the statements in the scriptures, there is empiric evidence, as I mentioned in the class. There is evidence to support the idea that human personality survives the death experience. And if they consider themselves like a person, I'm not a believer, you know, I believe in things that are scientific. Well, there's evidence you could present to them that has been, you know, produced by scientists, mainstream scientists, to that effect, to support that idea. Okay, anybody else, anything? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Sunday feast ki jai.